Our speaker today is Dr. Laura Donne. Laura got her PhD from ULB in Belgium, and then was a postdoctoral researcher at Harvard and a Black Hole Initiative fellow. And currently she's a Marie Sklodowska Curie fellow at the Technical University of Vienna. And she's been a key player in recent progress in recent years in using infinite dimensional symmetries near the black hole horizon and near null infinity in flat space to understand things about black hole physics and scattering amplitudes and take steps toward formulating a version of holography for flat space. And she will tell us about some of those things, I think, today. So whenever you're ready, go ahead, Laura.
Yes, thank you very much, Latham, for the nice introduction. And I want to thank the Perimeter Institute for the invitation. It's a great pleasure for me to present the research that I have been doing in the past few years. As Latham said, about black hole symmetries in gravity and also holography. So to me, black holes are really the most mysterious objects that are populating our universe. We know that black holes are a solution of Einstein's theory of general relativity, but amazingly, they're also astrophysical objects that are everywhere in our universe. And since April 2019, we have these amazing pictures of black hole in centers of galaxies, thanks to the Event Horizon Telescope. So you can see in this picture, black holes are characterized by Event Horizon, which is here in this dark region here. The Event Horizon of a black hole is the point of no return beyond which no matter no light can travel fast enough to escape the inexorable gravitational attraction of the hole. Therefore, they appear to be black. Black holes are also characterized by space-time singularity, where the laws of physics as we know them break down. Remarkably, we know since the work of Bekenstein and Hawking that black holes are thermodynamical objects. They have a temperature, the Hawking temperature, and an entropy. The Hawking temperature is inversely proportional to the mass of the black hole, and the formula for black hole's entropy is essentially telling us that the entropy goes with the event horizon area divided by 4. So you can see that in this very beautiful formula, many of the fundamental constants of nature appear, the speed of light, C, the Planck constant, and the Newton constant. So black holes are thought to be a key for understanding of quantum gravity. And indeed, black holes have compelled us to reconsider the fundamental laws of nature, and long-standing problems remain to be solved. One of them is, what is the origin of entropy for black holes? So we know that in statistical physics, the entropy is accounting for the number of microstates of the system. And we have had very nice results of accounting for the entropy from a statistical counting for certain class of black holes in string theory or in a lower space-time dimension. But what about realistic black holes, namely black holes that we see in the sky that are non-supersymmetric and live in 4 space-time dimensions? So to answer this question, it's important to remember that I think most of our understanding of quantum properties of black holes comes from the spectacular advances of the holographic correspondence. The holographic correspondence is the statement that the theory of quantum gravity, a theory of quantum gravity, is encoded in a lower dimensional theory. So a theory that doesn't involve gravity that lives in a lower dimensional spacetime. So this is why this correspondence seems to be holographic, because this theory that is encoding quantum gravity acts like a hologram and lives in a lower dimensional space-time. As such, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy law can be seen to be, in some sense, the primordial holographic relationship, because it's telling us that, remarkably, the entropy of the black hole scales with the area, that is, with the boundary of the volume of the black hole. So the holographic correspondent has provided theoretical physicists with extremely powerful techniques, but mostly they have been developed so far for a space-time with negative cosmological constant, that is, for the so-called anti-de Sitter space-times. And indeed, most of the success that we have had in accounting for black hole entropy can actually be seen to arise not related to the detail of string theory, but rather for the presence of an ADS factor in the near horizon region of the black hole that were studied. But realistic black holes like the Kerr solution do not possess an ADS near horizon region, nor do we live in a universe with negative cosmological constant. So these facts have compelled us to develop a holographic correspondence for asymptotically flat spacetime, which have vanishing cosmological constant. Of course, we know that we live in the de Sitter spacetime, but vanishing cosmological constant is a very good approximation for most astrophysical purposes. So this is what I will discuss in my talk. And as you will see, the core, everything that I will talk about will be centered around the theme of symmetries in gravity. Indeed, we know in physics that it's always a good idea to look at the symmetries of the problem before actually trying to solve it, as symmetries control universal phenomena and render computation feasible. So in this talk, I would like to present some recent advances in the holographic formulation of quantum gravity in asymptotically flat spacetime that goes under the name of celestial holography. I also want to show that there exists a very intriguing set of infinite dimensional symmetries in the near horizon region of black holes. And this has been a new active line of research. So the outline of the talk is as follows. So I will first review what are these infinite symmetries that I'm talking about and how they appear by looking at space-time, which are asymptotically flat. I will then show that these very rich symmetries have paved the way for a holographic correspondence in flat space-time called celestial holography. And finally, I will turn to black holes and I will show that very similar symmetries arise in their near horizon regions. And I will discuss the implications of all these programs, the potential connection between them and their implications. So let me start by presenting these symmetries. So I want to say before I start that you're very welcome to interrupt at any moment and to ask questions or for clarifications if needed. So let's start first with a simple case, which is the Minkowski metric in four space-time dimensions, which describe space-times that are flat. So Minkowski line element is described by this expression. So this line element simply measures the distance in flat space-time. Now, in the following of the talk, I will use this unusual coordinates, which are called the boundary coordinates, U, R, Z, and Z bar. So I'm just making a change of coordinate from this line element to this one. And the reason why I'm using this coordinate instead of the usual Cartesian ones will become clear in the following of the talk. In particular, you see that here what will be playing the role of the angles are these complex coordinate z and z bar. So z and z bar are related to the usual spherical coordinate theta and phi in this way. And they map the unit sphere metric to this expression with this function gamma z z bar. So the reason why I'm using this unusual coordinate is not to confuse you, it's just because, as you will see, it turns out to be very, very convenient. So an important picture that will appear several times in my talk is the Penrose diagram of Minkowski. A Penrose diagram is a very useful construction that is compactifying the space-time, but keeping the causal structure preserved. In particular, it brings the infinities at a finite distance, and the asymptotic infinity of flat space is called the future null infinity here, which is obtained when you take the radial coordinate very large and keep the other coordinates constant. So importantly, this is a null hypersurface, and the coordinate u runs along this null hypersurface is really a retarded time t minus r. That's why it's along a line of 45 degrees. And indeed, an important aspect about this Penrose diagram is to remember that light rays always propagate along line of 45 degrees in this diagram. Every point here on this picture is actually a two-sphere, but here the best I can draw is a circle, but you really have to think of each point in this diagram being a two-sphere, and the coordinate on the sphere are z and z bar. So the sphere at null infinity is called the celestial sphere, and this will be important in the following of the talk, so please keep this picture in mind. You have an analogous boundary at past null infinity, where you need to use a slightly different, now an advanced time to describe, but the structure is very similar. So now I want to look at more generic spacetimes, not exactly flat spacetime, but what I will call asymptotically flat spacetimes. So these spacetimes are curved spacetimes that look flat, seen from very far away. So they are obtained by adding to the Minkowski metric here on the left, new terms that are describing boundary condition for the metric fields. So here is a definition of asymptotically flat spacetime. So let me explain what this means. So here I've rewritten an asymptotic flat spacetime. So you can see that basically this is a large R expansion where the first approximation in Minkowski plus some corrections to the flat metric, which involve a certain powers of R, plus a bleeding correction that I'm not writing down. The functions in blue are interpreted as follow. So this function called MB is an arbitrary function of U, Z, and Z bar. And roughly speaking, it gives you the energy of the space-time. So if you, for instance, you take a Kerr metric and write it in these coordinates, the bond is called the bonding mass aspect. In this case, MB will just be a constant. It will be the mass of the Kerr black hole. Similarly, the NZ function here gives the angular momentum. Importantly, this function that is called CZZ indicates the presence of gravitational waves. More precisely, if the time derivative of this function is non-zero, it means that the system you are describing is emitting gravitational radiation. So for instance, if you have a black hole merger, it will emit gravitational wave. This wave will reach out to future null infinity, and this will be indicated by this quantity being non-zero. So you can simply regard this expression as a mathematical description of a space-time which is emitting gravitational wave. Now, a question that this gentleman asked is, what is the symmetry group of these spacetimes? So what they expected was to recover as a symmetry group the isometric group of Minkowski, which is the Poincaré group. Poincaré group consists of 4 spacetime translations, 3 space rotations, and 3 boosts. But surprisingly, what was found is actually an infinite dimensional extension of the Poincaré group, which is now called the BMS group. So how this infinite dimensional extension appear? When you look at asymptotic symmetries, the game that you are playing is you are actually looking for vector fields that are preserving this form of matrix. So in other words, the rules of the game is that you are allowed to change these functions in blue here when you act with the Lie derivative on the metric, but you are not allowed to change the powers in R in this expansion. So when you look for this sort of vector fields, you will find that it takes the following form. So the important thing about these vector fields is that it involves an arbitrary function. F here is an arbitrary function of the sphere angles, Z and Z bar. And these vector fields have been called as supertranslations. The reason why they are called supertranslation is because instead of just shifting, say, the retarded time by a mere constant, now you will be allowed to shift the time by an arbitrary amount depending on which point on the celestial sphere you are at. So in other words, since this f of z and z bar is an arbitrary function on the sphere, you have an infinite amount of super of translations, and that's why they were called super translations. So super doesn't have nothing to do with supersymmetry. This is just to indicate that you have way more ways of shifting the coordinates. Actually, you can do it in an infinite amount of ways. So the summary of this part is that the symmetric group of asymptotically flat spacetime is way bigger than the one of Minkowski space. And this infinite dimensional extension of Poincaré goes under the name of the BMS group, standing for Bondi-Messner-Zachs. So what these gentlemen have found is maybe a prime example of symmetry enhancement, where the 4 Poincaré translations are enhanced to an infinite amount of super translations. I want to point out that the BMS symmetry were originally disregarded. Actually, when these gentlemen found the BMS symmetries, they were really upset because they really wanted to recover the Poincaré group as the symmetry group of asymptotically flat spacetimes. So what they tried to do is they tried to kill by hand the BMS supertranslations by imposing stronger boundary conditions. But when you do that, you realize that what you are actually doing when you want to kill supertranslation, it amounts actually to kill all kind of radiation in the system. So as soon as you want to describe space-time which are emitting gravitational waves, you have supertranslations. And this was actually the motivation of these people, was to understand gravitational radiation. So the BMS symmetries today have actually given us a bunch of surprises, as they were shown to connect different topics in physics and to have a deep implication in the infrared structure of gravity that I will discuss now. If there is a question, let me know.
Can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
If we go back to the metric for the asymptotically flat space-time,
Yes.
I just want to make sure, is this metric supposed to satisfy the Einstein equation?
Yes, yes, exactly. So the Einstein's equations have been imposed here, and in particular, they will impose you some constrained equation on these two quantity MB and NZ. So there are actually further constrained equation for this quantity. So the Einstein's equation will tell you how the bonding mass, for instance, evolve in time. I have not written that down, but basically, this is what the Einstein's equation will tell you.
Uh-huh. And when you say asymptotic symmetries, those symmetries will map one of such metric to maybe another that still satisfies the Einstein equation.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And you mentioned that it will impose some conditions on MB and NZ, but not on CZZ.
No, that's right. So CZZ is really what is called a gravitational data, meaning that this is not constrained by the equation of motion. So you have to give it as a data. So it's this the status of this function is slightly different from the other ones, which are subject to constraints.
Uh-huh. And what does the boundary condition impose other constraints on them? The boundary condition.
So the boundary conditions are basically telling you what kind of asymptotic symmetries you will find, because basically what you are looking for is the symmetry that preserve these boundary conditions, so these falloffs. So this powers in R.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Eric, I see you have a question.
Yes, I do. You mentioned the Poincaré symmetries, essentially assuming you have 10 symmetries, but you could apply local Poincaré symmetries. That would also be a very large symmetric group. Do I misunderstand something, or is that not relevant for the talk? Is this just an introduction?
Yes, so I'm not sure if this is what you are asking, but in these Poincaré, you have 4 translation and 6 Lorentz transformations. And what I'm emphasizing here is how to enhance the 4 translation to an infinite amount. But actually, there is also a very rich story of how you can enhance to an infinite amount of way the Lorentz transformation. And these are called super rotations. I will just briefly talk about it later, but yes, there is also a very rich story along that line that is actually important.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Go for it, Lee.
Yes, when you say these were disregarded, I think their importance was disregarded, but people like Penrose and Abhayashikar understood the geometry pretty well. I think they understood that going to Minkowski spacetime as R gets large had global ambiguities because there are many different gauge inequivalent asymptotic Minkowski spacetime.
Right, yes, yes. Yeah, indeed, I think that at some point the analysis of Bondi, Messner, Zak was traded for the analysis of Penrose in the more compactive and compactifying the conformal compactification of null infinity. So they were also there. That's true. Any more question? Okay, if not, I will continue. So I was just telling you that these BMS symmetries were actually found to show important relationships with other phenomena in physics. And the thing I want to present here is how actually they are related to sub-theorems in quantum field theory. So sub-theorems are statements when you have a scattering amplitude. So basically, the sub-theorem that was found by Weinberg in the 60s is basically telling you that if you have an amplitude, which can be written as this S matrix element, with n particle plus an extra particle that is taking to be soft, a soft particle means that its energy omega goes to zero. Well, this theorem is telling you that this amplitude will factorize and will roughly speaking be given by the amplitude without the soft particle time a factor, which is called a soft factor. So it's a factorization statement about amplitudes when one zero energy particle is added. What was found by Strominger and collaborator is that this subgraviton theorem can be understood from symmetry principles. And actually, this theorem is nothing but the word identity that is associated to the support translation symmetry I have just presented. So this is the word identity where S is the S matrix and this QF is the Noether charge that is associated to super translation symmetry. The plus means that it's at future infinity and the minus at past infinity. But so basically the idea is that if you take this wired identity, you can actually show that this will give you exactly the soft graviton theorem.
Can I ask you a question,
please? Yes.
What identities are exact, right? But the soft graviton theorem gives you an expansion. So how come you're saying they're the same?
Yes. So I mean, here the Noether charge is really taking at you expand at large R, but then you take it's really a boundary charge. So it's exact on the boundary. There is no 1/r in this expression anymore. So that's how it happens.
I see. So you take a word identity then you take a soft expansion of it or something.
Yeah, so the word identity you really plug, what you plug really is it is Noether charge. So I'm not explaining, unfortunately, how to construct it and how this statement can be made concise, because there are a lot of steps from going to this expression to that expression, actually. Okay. But basically, the key idea is that you have the symmetry, you construct a charge that is, and you drop the 1/r terms, you have a charge that is defined on the boundary, and inserting this charge, you find this. But there, it's not so easy to see without doing all the okay. steps in between. Yeah, thank you. So yeah, I mean, this is one of the relationship that consists of the so-called infrared triangle, which connects different topics in physics, which a priori have very little to do with each other. So the first topic is this topic of asymptotic symmetry in general relativity that I have started to introduce. And the second one is the sub-theorems in quantum field theory. And so far you can tell me this is just a mere mathematical curiosity and this is maybe not so exciting at all, but a very important aspect, the third corner of this triangle is played by the so-called memory effects. So memory effects are observational effects that arise in general relativity, and these were studied starting from the 70s and revisited in the 90s. So the memory effects, so we often hear that gravitational waves squeeze and stretch space-time, but what we do not often hear is that long after the gravitational waves has passed through a detector, there will be a permanent trace of the fact that the gravitational waves have passed. So these memory effects is what they are. They are permanent displacement after the passage of a gravitational wave. So for instance, here you have a gravitational wave signal and it oscillates, and memory is telling you that there will be a permanent displacement in the signal, there will be an offset, and people have actually actually propose to measure this memory effect very soon at a LIGO or LISA. And so there is a great chance that that we measure this effect very soon. And what is remarkable is that these memory effects is the physical effect that is associated to the existence of super translation symmetry. So in other words, two metrics that differ by a super translations are actually, it's actually equivalent to see that this has to do with the memory effect, the displacement memory effect. So this triangle is establishing a relationship between these topics in physics. And I want to point out here that I've been talking mostly about gravity, but this set of relationship is much broader than that. It's actually not only for gravity, but also for gauge theories in different amount of space-time dimensions. So I will not talk about all these copies, but this is just to show you that there is a very rich story that is not restricted to a specific theory in a specific setup. So now let me move to the second part of the talk, which is this celestial holography story. So as I said in the beginning of my talk, a beautiful story has been developed over the last 20 years that has revealed a detailed structure about quantum gravity in space-time, which are the so-called ADS space-times. Indeed, the groundbreaking realization of the holographic correspondence is the so-called ADS CFT correspondence, which is stating that quantum gravity in ADS can be equivalently described as a conformal field theory that lives at the boundary of the space-time. So conformal field theory is a quantum field theory that is invariant under conformal transformations. This is an example of a conformal transformation. Basically, it's a transformation that preserves the angle. So now what about flat space-times? Is there a dual CFT? Where does it live? What are these properties and how does this even work? That's what I want to discuss now. So a first thing to notice is that the causal structure of Minkowski, of the boundary of Minkowski, is very different from the boundary of ADS. So here in Minkowski, we have this null hypersurface, this future null infinity boundary, which is null, as opposed to the time-like, the boundary of ADS, which is time-like. So that's the first thing to notice. And we have this, this celestial sphere, which is the two sphere at infinity. So again, let's look at symmetries. A first important observation is that in the bulk of Minkowski, we have 4D Lorentz invariants. And when we look at how the Lorentz groups acts on the celestial sphere, namely on this coordinate z bar, we see that this action is nothing but the 2D conformal group or the SL2C or sometimes called the Möbius transformation. So this fact has actually paved the way for a concrete proposal for what would celestial holography look like. And the claim is that the four-dimensional S matrix is encoded in a two-dimensional conformal field theory that lives on the celestial sphere. So the conformal field theory that is dual to gravity in flat space-time is called a celestial conformal field theory. So basically, this word celestial is just to tell you that first, it lives on the celestial sphere. And second, that it's not a conformal field theory as we are used to. It's basically, I will discuss this later, but this dual field theory has very important differences with the usual CFT in ADS. So let me make this explain a little bit more in detail what I mean by that. So the claim is that if you have gravity scattering amplitude in four-dimensional spacetimes, you will want to recast this as some correlator, two-dimensional correlator, in terms of operators that lives on the two sphere. So if you have, remember that I'm focusing on massless particles. So a massless particles always enter flat space coming from scry minus and always exit flat space at scry plus. So a particle that enter spacetime with this momentum will enter or exit the point in the sphere at this angle. So the idea is that in this dictionary, each incoming or outgoing particle will be described by an operator labeled by the point z and z bar where the particle is coming from and pierces the celestial sphere at future or past infinity. So let me again be a little more precise and introduce a new formulation for asymptotic particles. So we are used to work in this plane wave basis where particles are described in terms of their four momenta p mu and their helicity. Now for holography in flat spacetime, it turns out to be very convenient to work with so-called conformal basis where which consists of Mellin transform of plane waves. So this integral here is a Mellin transform. And why we want to work with this object rather than plane waves is because when you do this Mellin transform, then your the labels now will be, instead of the momenta, will be this delta, this is a conformal dimension delta, and a point z bar on the sphere. And the advantage of doing so is that now you will have very manifest conformal properties that you didn't have in the usual plane wave basis. On the other hand, the translation symmetry is now more obscured. So now we want to work with this this Mellin transform of the plane waves, which are labeled by a point, z and z bar, and the conformal dimension delta. And I told you before that an important role is played by soft particles, where we have all these nice soft theorems, for which the energy omega is taken to zero. But now, as you can see, in this new basis that is adapted for holography, the notion of energy is lost because you trade, by doing this integral, you trade the energy omega for this new variable delta. So what is the analog of a soft particle in this celestial formulation? And this led us to propose with Andrea Poom and Andy Strominger the new notion of a conformal soft particles for which the conformal dimension takes specific value. So here I want to sketch. This is the most technical slide of my presentations. So I don't want to enter into too much details here, but what I want to point out is that what we did so far is that we have found for different cases, the currents, a two-dimensional currents that lives on the celestial sphere that are responsible for a soft theorem in quantum field theory. So I mostly told you about this story, which has to do with supertranslation and the soft graviton theorem. But as I suggested, the story also carries on for gauge symmetries. In this case, the relevant theorem is the soft photon theorem. And you have a much richer story with a subleading symmetry. This has to do with the super rotations story that I was asked about. So in all these cases, we constructed an object that transformed like a current, so like a U1 catch Moody or a 2D stress tensor on the celestial sphere. So there is actually a much richer story that is expecting to hold, and is some work of progress. But so the idea is that to obtain as much constraint as we can on the dual field theory and see what these sub-theorems mean on the celestial picture and how they can help us to construct the dual theory for flat space. So let me just give you a more broad picture about this program. So celestial holography is giving us also a new window into scattering amplitudes. So the celestial correlators, as I said, are obtained by doing a Mellin transform of the scattering amplitudes. And these objects here on the right, these relations have been computing a great amount of example by all these people. And what we are starting to see is that the celestial amplitude, so meaning the scattering amplitude recast in a holographic basis, are unveiling a hidden mathematical structure that were not accessible from traditional formulation. They also provide new organizing principles and give new insights about any enigmatic feature of scattering. So a second point I want to emphasize is that celestial holography is in a way forcing us to go beyond ADS holography. In anti-de-Sitter, you have radiation cannot escape. ADS acts like a box. While in celestial holography, you do allow for outgoing radiation. And it's important to notice that celestial holography, you have a lot of infinite, you have actually many infinities of symmetry constraints that are coming on top of what we are used to coming from ADS. So for instance, you have this super translation symmetry that I talked about, which has no analog in usual ADS holography. And it gives rise to intriguing features that are providing us actually with powerful constraint on the celestial CFT. So far this story has been just started to be developed. So there is no full understanding so far of what a celestial CFT is, or even what are all the sets of property that it has to obey. But the idea is that by exploring more these all this, we will be able to come with a very powerful constraint and to have a clear understanding of what it has to obey. So this, I think is now is a good point for questions.
Yes, can you hear me?
If there are. Yes, I can.
Hello? Yes. Mm-hmm. So is it fair to say that a celestial quanta in your language is very non-local, is spread all over the light cone from the base of U up to time-like infinity. You're integrating over all of U. So a scattering of quanta from the space-time point of view in the bulk of Minkowski space-time looks very non-local.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I have traded the time coordinates for this conformite dimension delta. For the energy, and then I'm integrating over all energies. So so that's a very important feature.
Yes, that's very beautiful.
So before I turn to the last part, is there any other question?
Maybe I can ask, are there yet any examples known or hoped for examples of problems that would be sort of solvable from this standpoint that wouldn't be solvable from the traditional side of the duality, or is it more about reformulating things in a hopefully more
So
insightful way.
Yeah. So the idea is that, of course, it's more than a mere rewriting, because if you want these conformal properties are built up by the fact that you do this Malin transform and so on and so forth. But they are actually new insights that you can get from this formulation that you cannot from the usual formulation. So for instance, you can actually see that precisely because you are summing, integrating of all energy, there is no longer UVRRIR decoupling. So in other words, you cannot really do an effective field theory description. So you are forced, when you work with this celestial amplitude, you are forced from the, by definition, to work with the full UV and RIR mixing at the same time. So they are very fundamental differences that compared to the usual formulations, because you are summing over all this.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, thank you. Okay, so let me better start talking about this last part. So now let me change a little bit my focus of attention and look about and go in the near horizon region of black holes. So far I've been looking at far away. Now I want to focus on the near horizon region of black holes. So what we have looked at is we have looked at, you see, in the beginning I told you, you can make an expansion near future null infinity. Now what we did is we did an expansion near the black hole horizon, which in this set of coordinates is located, is this null hypersurface located at rho equals zero. So you can actually show that this is a very generic way of writing a near horizon metric for any sort of black hole. And again, this function here, kappa is related to surface gravity, and you have these functions in blue, which are arbitrary function of every coordinate except of rho. So you now doing a small rho expansion. And when you look at the vector fields that preserve this form of metric, you actually find a very reminiscently to what happens for BMS, like in BMS, you find a super translation symmetry and super rotation symmetry. And crucially, these asymptotic symmetry or near horizon symmetry, you can compute the neutral charges that are associated to it, and you find that they are non-zero. So they are really genuine physical symmetries that act on the near horizon regions. So the conclusion of what we have observed is that black holes exhibit a very rich, actually infinite dimensional amount of symmetries. You have the super translation and super rotations that are very reminiscent of the BMS symmetry and null infinity. And these symmetries are sometimes called a soft hair in the literature. So we often hear that black holes have no hair, which is a very funny way of saying that black holes basically all look the same. They are uniquely characterized by their mass and angular momentum. And this statement is true up to diffeomorphisms. And these BMS transformations are diffeomorphisms that change the physical state. So the Nutter chart that were found associated to this symmetry provide a kind of infinite amount of hair, which were called soft hair, for the black hole. So we seem to have all these, this soft hair were originally proposed by Stephen Hawking, Malcolm Perry, and Andy Strominger. And the hope is that by better understanding the full implication of these symmetries, we will be able to address important questions such as, are these soft hair enough to account for the entropy of the black hole? And there also has been some lot of debate and discussion to see whether this soft hair would bear on the longstanding problem of informational puzzle. So let me finish the talk by presenting you, I think what I find is very amazing connections between gravity and hydrodynamics, which has to do with these near horizon symmetries, of course. So the first observation of this connection was done by Thibaut Damour in the late 70s, where in his thesis, he made the observation that an observer that would remain outside the black hole would see the horizon to behave according to the equation that describe a fluid bubble with a definite shear, bulk viscosity, and so on. This observation has been further developed by Thorne, Price, and MacDonald, notably in this book here, and it's called the membrane paradigm. So the membrane paradigm is a way to look at a black hole. So it amounts to consider the black hole as a dynamical fluid membrane that is obeying, for instance, the Navier-Stokes equations. So it's a very convenient, paradigm for astrophysical purpose to replace the black hole event horizon by this membrane. So the membrane here, this membrane is really a hypersurface that is not exactly the black hole horizon, which is here at rho equals zero, but it's a constant rho hypersurface that is just slightly outside the black hole event horizon. So sometimes it's called the stretch horizon or the membrane. And with this in mind, what we discovered last year with Charles Marteau is that when you take the near horizon limit of a black hole, you can actually totally reinterpret this as taking some sort of ultra-relativistic limit. So ultra-relativistic limit, there is a limit where the speed of light goes to zero. Here, the speed of light is a virtual speed of light that is identified with the radial coordinates. And the beautiful thing about that is that all the dynamics about the black hole horizon, the expansion, the shear, and so on, is then entirely captured by conservation laws that are ultra-relativistic. So this provides a new way of viewing the membrane in this membrane paradigm as now an ultra-relativistic fluid that is subject to chiral symmetry. So the word chiral and ultra-relativistic are usually used together. So the reason why they were called chiral has to do with the writer of Alice in Wonderland. The reason is that in the ultra-relativistic world, as opposed to a Galilean world, you can actually see that space is absolute and time intervals are arbitrary. So you don't have any notion of causality and you have a very funny experience of living in a Chaolian world, very much like what Alice went through when she was in her adventure, especially this tea party moment where the time interval seems to be totally arbitrary. So I'm reaching the end of my talk. So let me finish by conclusions and future prospects. So I have showed you that both the faraway regions and the black hole near horizon regions exhibit a very rich amount of symmetries. And the overarching goal of my research is actually to combine these two approaches and these two regions, near horizon and far away. So let me just mention some recent advances that goes along these lines. One of them was to define this so-called, what we call black hole memory effect, where it's a process where a shock wave is prepared at past infinity and hits a Schwarzschild black hole. And we show that the effect of the shock wave would be to turn on some super translation and super rotation charge on the black hole. So this is a way, if you want to implant a hair on the black hole metric. And then another recent work has to do with, we could actually we were actually able to map in a certain conformally flat spacetime the BMS charges to their horizon char by making use of conformal symmetry. So by combining these regions and approach, I want to address, of course, the important question of entropy, the global form of the conservation laws, and potentially unveil new kind of memory effects and new observables. So I think that there has been a beautiful story that has starting to emerge, in my opinion. So the more I've been exploring these topics, the more I think we are aiming at a fundamental organizing principle of symmetries and gravity. And one of the lessons that I have learned is that we have systematically, well, in the literature, over-constraining boundary conditions and gauge fixing have been imposed. And this has really prevented us from seeing many important symmetries and observables. And there have been also very few systematic approach. This is just an example of how we see that the symmetry we thought were relevant were actually found to be bigger and bigger and richer and richer. And so I think we need to go really beyond these approaches of imposing boundary conditions, and because we have seen that we have lost many important things. And this resonates very much with the recent advances that has been done at Perimeter about this edge modes and corner symmetries. So I think this is a very good moment where this community can actually combine their approaches. And I think that many fascinating connections are just waiting to be explored. So thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Laura, for that terrific colloquium. Let me start by asking, are there any questions from students in the audience?
Hello.
Hello.
This is Rufus, and I'm a member of EHT, Human Horizon Telescope. So one of my questions, what kind of observable in the future, what kind of observable will be there for us to observe to verify, for example, your theory, your metric, and
you mean especially for the event horizon or more broadly speaking?
Observational purpose.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So there, the main very important observable has to do with. What I mentioned very quickly about these memory effects. So these memory effects can be observed very soon at LIGO or LISA. So, and they are really the measurement of this symmetry, of these asymptotic symmetries of flat spacetimes. And now we have seen that actually there are new kinds of memory that have been looked at. So this is the first very important and very achievable, I mean, we know that this memory effect for a long time, it's just a matter of time before we measure it. And that would be amazing because it would be really a concrete footprints of this symmetry of flat space. Now, what I'm dreaming about is whether all this near horizon symmetry could tell us something about black hole shadow and something we could even observe at EHC. So far I don't have a concrete statement, but that would be, I think, amazing.
Okay, thank you.
Any other student questions? If not, Lee, I see you have your hand up. Go ahead.
I'm fascinated by this Mellon transform. And so what you get is a theory on an S2 cross an S1, identifying the infrared with the ultraviolet. Do observables then have to do with topological degrees of freedom on that S2 cross S1?
Maybe this is the right thing to think. I mean, I didn't think about it that way, but So yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think this, but yeah, what is really key about this Malin transform is that, yeah, it really forces you to work with the full towers of all energy, and it mixes around the asymptotic states, and it's not merely a change of basis. It's really has the potential to bring a new insight about most general holographic principle. Yeah.
Sure. So the other obvious question is, does this have anything to do with twister theory?
Yes. I think it has to. I mean, it's something that has not been fully fleshed out, but at least it's secretly, probably if we work in twister space, I mean, everything will become very, very natural. And I think it has to be very deeply related to that. Yeah.
Yeah. So if I had to make a guess, I would combine the two things I said, that it has to do with wrapping of topological numbers in twister space.
Okay.
Anyway, thank you very much. It's very,
yeah,
great.
Thank you.
Yushin, go ahead.
Thanks. I just wonder if you can say more about the memory effects.
Yeah, yes. So, let me say that there are two kinds of memory. There is one that is called the linear memory effect that was found by Thorne and people. And then later on, Christodoulou in the 90s took take into account the non-linear effects. And so, yeah, basically the memory is really what it is. It's a change in the quadrupolar pieces of the 1/r spatial part of a transless traceless projection of the metric. So this is really what it is, mathematically speaking. Now I can tell you that it's a very low frequency effect, so it has probably better chances to be measured our LISA detector because it's a really free floating detectors. And yeah, basically it's an effect. This is the memory effect. Is something that as soon as you have gravitational waves, you have this effect. So if you have black hole merger, you will have that, but also gamma ray bursts. And basically, yeah, this is what it is about.
Okay. So in the triangle, in the infrared triangle.
Yes.
These things are equivalent in the sense that if you have one of them, you necessarily have the other two, and if you don't have one of them, you will not have any other.
That's the idea. Now, what I can say is that in some cases, so yeah, that's what is great about this triangle is that it was used to sometimes you knew one corner of the triangle, and if you believe that this story is very generic and universal, then you can infer new physics on a different side. I have to say that not all the triangles have been completed so far. Namely, there are some cases when you know, I don't know, for instance, I know there are some, there has been some relationship in super symmetry, but there was no memory effect that were studied so far. So not all the triangles have been completed so far, not even all the copies of the triangle have been found, but that's the idea, is that there is really a universal structure that if you find one corner, you'd better look for, it's actually very interesting to look for the other sides, and you will find new memory. So what have been done, I can tell you a little bit, is that for instance, there was a new self theorem that was found by Frederic Acceso and Strominger because they knew that there was a super rotation symmetry. So this is an example where you can actually see that by knowing a part, you look for the other side and usually you find something very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Okay, maybe last question, Naritaka.
thank you very much for a nice talk. So I have one question. Well, do you think such a rich symmetry exists even on the Dozhita horizon, since the present universe may be a Dozhita universe? So I'm just wondering. Yeah.
Sorry, can you say again your question? You are wondering where the symmetries?
Such a rich symmetry, mm-hmm. like as you said, just a black hole horizon and the future infinity has a rich symmetries.
Yes.
I'm wondering the Dozhita horizon.
The De Sitter horizon.
The De Sitter. Yes, actually, we also looked at the zero horizon with Gaston Jerry, but we looked at that. So it's not only for event horizon, it's also whole for cosmological horizon. I didn't have time to talk about that, but thanks for asking. It's not only for, it's also for cosmological, yeah.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. All right. Maybe in view of time, let's close it there and thank Laura one last time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.